Kevin Duskel from Department of Transportation, State Highway Traffic Safety. I have the pleasure of introducing Mark Sabota this afternoon. I promised Mark that you would not make a sound in the audience, and please keep those jokes to anyway. So again, I have the pleasure of introducing Mark. Mark brings over 30 years of experience in probation and court services. His full bio is online. I'm going to just do an abbreviated. Basically, he travels around the country and does training for high-risk impaired drivers. We're lucky to have Mark here in Montana, so please enjoy your lunch and welcome Mark on stage.
Thank you very much. I'm really glad you're not eating like corn nuts. That probably would get a little bit old. I'm very glad to be here. I am the American Probation Parole Association Probation Fellow, and you're probably all wondering, what is a probation fellow? I'm going to tell you. My position is funded by NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and so I have the honor of traveling around the country doing trainings and technical assistance for probation departments, courts, basically anybody who's willing to listen to me on issues surrounding high-risk drunk drivers. So not those first-time offenders or the second-time offenders, the people that typically end up in DUI court or hybrid drug court. So, and this is my third trip to Billings, and I love being here. I used to come here as a child to a Duke branch. I won't tell you when, because it'll be really depressing for me to share that information. So, I do have a quick question before I roll into this. How many probation officers are in the audience? Just a couple. Any of those probation officers, do any of you have DUI-specific caseloads? Or that's all you have? One? Okay. You tell your boss when you get back to wherever you're coming from, you deserve a big raise. Because that's really, really heavy lifting. So here's what I'm going to try to do in the next about 45 minutes or so. I want to talk to you about issues related to drug impaired driving. And this has been a huge issue for NHTSA, especially since we've had nine states now that have legalized recreational marijuana. This is really jumping to the forefront. And when I go through some of these statistics with you, I think you're going to understand why this really is such a significant issue. So what I hope to do is talk about basically the magnitude of DUI problem, marijuana and driving and how that's really come to the forefront, some of the unique challenges in dealing with this population. And then I want to spend a little bit of time about what does it mean for you in problem-solving courts? What does it mean for you when it comes to supervision of this population? And how do they look different than your typical DUI case you might be dealing with? So I want to start with a couple photographs for you, and nothing that hopefully will disturb your lunch, nothing graphic. So it's not unusual for somebody who is impaired to drive into the first floor of a building, but it takes a very special person to land in the second story of a building. And in this case, we have an individual, this is in California, who ended up in the second floor of a dentist's office. Thank goodness this was on a weekend when the place was closed. But part of the reason that I mention this is it received a fair amount of attention. This was in California, of course. If ever there's going to be a place with flying cars, it would probably be California. But it received attention from media. And credit to the media, they were able to discriminate that this was not a drunk driver. This was somebody who was impaired on other drugs. In addition to alcohol. I'm from Wisconsin originally, and small town right near where I grew up, a friend of mine sent me this picture of an individual. It takes a special driver to pancake into the side of the house, which this individual did. Acknowledged he had been smoking marijuana and drinking all day, and the end result was what you see in the side of this individual's house. Third picture, some of you may or may not have seen, but what I'd like you to do is draw your attention to the back seat of this vehicle. This is a photograph of a couple that went to their dealer to get high. they couldn't wait until they got back home, so they both shot up before they went home. End result was they passed out in the vehicle of their car, and their five-year-old son, you can see in the back of the vehicle. So if you ever want a kind of an emblematic photo of how drug use impacts everybody, not just the user, I think this is an excellent example of that. So, drug impaired driving, we have celebrities who had been arrested. Tiger Woods was stopped. He had Ambien in his system in addition to alcohol and some other drugs. My co-presenter, who's normally with me, put this together. I don't know, the woman on the upper left was in like Real Housewives of Missoula or something like that. I don't know. But she also was hot for drug driving, and John Stamos, same thing, he was stopped for driving under the influence of marijuana. So we're getting more attention to this, and there's some really important reasons why this needs to be drawing our attention, because of the challenges we have with social norming, especially when it comes to marijuana and driving. So what I first want to do is kind of give you an idea what the state of the state is when it comes to DUIs and the progress we've made, and how we need to be making some of that same progress when we're talking about drug-impaired driving. So I've got some statistics that are hot off the press for you, and there is some good news. One is that the number of DUI fatalities in this country has gone down. 2015 and 16, they started to move up, which was really becoming a concern for NHTSA and anybody involved with working with this population. Why are we starting to see this uptick in more deaths due to drunk driving? And I'm going to tell you, again, this information was released about 2 weeks ago. Core facts are that whenever we would talk about issues of drunk driving fatalities, and talk about states, Montana was always not number one, it was like number two or number three. So I don't know what happened in Montana, but in 2017, which is our most recent reporting year, those DUI fatalities went from 43% to 30%. So, you know, it's hard to celebrate when anybody is killed by a drunk driver, but that is a really, really significant drop. So I don't know if people are getting the message. I can't tell you why this is happening, but it's certainly encouraging. So people understand, by and large, that drinking and driving is a bad thing. If any of you have kids under the age of, say, 25, and I would include my daughter in this, they never go anywhere if they're going to drink without using Uber. And it's not that I beat it into her head. They just got it. That is part of their thing. So that social norming, the vast majority of people get that. When it comes to marijuana and other drugs, not so much. So some of the reasons that we have been making progress with this population is information that our legislature has been really catching on to, them passing laws that have an impact on this. How law enforcement is dealing with this has certainly made a difference. Countermeasures using an ignition interlock, other alcohol technologies have made a difference. Targeting high-risk offenders and using alcohol-specific assessment tools to address it have certainly helped. Public education, again, that social norming piece, changing those societal norms, all those things have made a difference in what we see when it comes to impaired driving. So now let me talk to you about what we're seeing with DUID, driving under the influence of drugs. One of the biggest challenges we have is what information states are reporting. And because of that, we had some real challenges of knowing exactly what is going on with their drivers. And the rates of this information was reported by the states to NHTSA and other government organizations varies from like 10% to 90 or something. So the information I'm going to give you is based on those individuals that were involved with fatality accidents that were tested for drugs. But again, the numbers that we have don't reflect the population. And I naively always assumed that when somebody was killed in an accident where they suspect that drugs or alcohol were used, that there would be testing that takes place. That is not the case. So that's one of the things we really have to be worried about and moving forward on. The other thing is, with this information, presence of drugs in somebody's system does not necessarily mean that they were under the influence of those drugs. So, for example, if I were a daily marijuana user and I stopped smoking on Monday and I got into a fatality accident on Wednesday, there may be the presence of marijuana in my system, but that doesn't mean that I was impaired by marijuana at the time. So that's just one of the challenges that we deal with. But here are some statistics that I want to give you about basically what we have been seeing, some of the changes with drug-impaired driving. So if you look at that kind of aqua-colored graph, far left is 2006. And what it shows is that 41% of the people that were tested for drugs and alcohol, 41% of them were under the influence of alcohol. That same year, 27, almost 28% of that population tested as being positive for some sort of drug in their system, marijuana or opioids, etc. Now you look to the far right, in 2016, which is the last reporting year that NHTSA had done this work, about 38% of those individuals tested were under the influence of alcohol, and almost 44% were under the influence of marijuana or other drugs. So for the first time, we're seeing that drugs are more common, and marijuana is more common in fatalities than alcohol. So that is the big concern that we're seeing with these drivers. Some of the other bits of information I want to share with you, 38% of fatal injured drivers, marijuana, 4% marijuana and opioids, and then 42% other drugs. So it gives you an idea how common this is to find these sort of drugs in the system of drivers. Some other information, 22.5% of nighttime drivers tested positive for legal prescription or over-the-counter medications, and only 1.5% of nighttime drivers tested positive for VAC over 0.08. So that's about a 16% increase over 2007. This is a statistic I really want you to be thinking is a takeaway. And I want to draw your attention to two things. This is roadside surveys. Column on the left are individuals who tested positive for a drug or medication during the week, so a weekday. And the column on the right is people who tested positive for alcohol or a drug weekend nights. So if you look at the bottom, and this probably isn't going to be a surprise, weekdays, about 1.1% of the individuals tested positive for alcohol. Weekend nights, about 8.3%. So, you know, obviously, Friday night, Saturday night, you're going out for dinner, you're going to a bar, you're much less likely to have people drinking in the morning. Now, look right above that for marijuana. 11.7% tested positive during weekday days and 12.6% on weekends. So there's hardly any difference between the weekday marijuana user and the weekend night marijuana user. So you could say that marijuana is the anytime drug. People don't think twice about smoking during the day, maybe smoking before they're going to work. So again, another challenge that we're faced with. That's this one. With all the studies that are out there, there are mixed, lots and lots of mixed findings. There are some studies that say if you're looking at marijuana alone, we're not seeing a specific difference between the marijuana-using driver and the non-marijuana-using driver, especially when it comes to impairment. There are other studies that are showing that people who tested positive for marijuana, there's an increase in crash information. So that information varies pretty widely in terms of what we're seeing. But this is something that we know, and this is probably one of the more significant bits of research that we find. And that is, when it comes to impaired drivers, 1 + 1 does not equal 2, it equals 3. And by that I mean, if you're using marijuana and you're using alcohol with it, your risk to be involved in a crash or hurt somebody else goes up astronomically. And that is one of the common themes that we see with individuals who are arrested for DUI is they're poly substance abusers. These are the people that if they don't find alcohol, they'll find weed. If they can't find weed, they'll go and check out grandma's medicine cabinet and they'll find something. So it's not unusual for these individuals to have 2 or 3 or more substances on board at the time that they're stopped. This was a study on drivers in Europe and crash risk based on drugs that were used. And if you look at this marijuana only, the risk goes up by about 3 times, which is significant, but not as significant as when you look at alcohol together with other drugs. 200 to 300 times greater likelihood of getting into a crash by using those substances. So in a way, alcohol is kind of that common denominator that can really cause problems. A couple studies I want to share with you. One from Dane County, Wisconsin, where my alma mater is, Figures, where they tested individuals who were stopped for DUI low over a 0.10, and they tested them even though the arresting officer was not looking for drugs. And they found that about 40% of the time there were other drugs on board. Did the same thing in Dade County, Florida, where they, again, arrested people for suspicion of DUI. They drug tested them as well, and about that same percentage they found drugs in their system as well. So let's talk about perception. Any of you recognize these two? I'm going to show you a quick video. Driving 35 on the freeway, it is actually speeding. But here are some of the perceptions that we have to deal with when it comes to impaired driving. Drug driving is not a serious problem. I'm fine to drive. There are lots of people who smoke marijuana that will swear to their dying day that they are a better driver under the influence than when they're not using at all. I drive better when I'm high. There are no laws against drug-impaired driving. It's not illegal. Law enforcement can't tell if I'm high. So These are really, really common. And, it's better than driving drunk. That's another one that you hear quite a bit, just from the general population in terms of how they perceive marijuana. So this is a Gallup poll, and if you look at it, on the top left, 79% of the people polled said that alcohol is a very serious problem, and about 29% said driving under the influence of marijuana is a very serious problem, but about 31% said, it's not a problem, it's not an issue. Same Gallup poll, when people question about whether or not legalization of marijuana in your state is going to make any difference, when it comes to driving, about half of people said, no, it's really not going to make that much of a difference. So dealing with these perceptions is a challenge. I'm going to show you a couple videos. One is from Colorado, and the other one is Canada, and it's really addressing how to get the message across that you don't get high and get behind the wheel of a car. And one of the things that they're doing, and I think it's very smart, is that they're really doing an emphasis on humor, especially trying to attract younger people when it comes to this issue. I'll just tell you, personally, I'm in Arizona, and the PSAs that we have for drinking and driving, in my humble opinion, are pretty worthless. It's a DPS officer saying, if you drive high, we will catch you. Now, research shows that in urban areas, the number of times people drive impaired is around 200 times. And in rural areas, which is by most of Montana, typically we're looking at 2,000 times driving impaired before you're caught. So for somebody to say, we're going to catch you, what are you going to be thinking if you live in a rural area? Yeah, right. I've driven 2,000 times high or drunk. What do you think the likelihood is that you're going to catch me at number 2001? So let me show you a couple of these. This is from Canada, where marijuana was just restarted.
Let's check it out.
Hello, my name is Jennifer. I'm
21. Excuse me. You haven't smoked any pot today. I've been stopped here for 15 minutes. Can you tell me why that is?
We're waiting for the stop sign to turn green.
How are you? Okay, I am going to have to conduct a pot sobriety test.
Oh man, I'm too high for that.
Is that breathalyzer?
No. I'm going to ask you a few questions to determine your ability to drive. Why is that pizza box square when the pizza is a circle and all the little slices are tiny triangles? Which of these two snacks would you prefer? Chips or the cookie dough? Step out of the car, please.
Please, don't drive high.
So moving right along, let's talk about the effects of drugs on driving. So this is what we know about cannabis, 480 chemical compounds, so it's a much different animal than when we're talking about alcohol, especially when we're talking about testing, which I'll get into. So generally speaking, these are the signs and symptoms of marijuana usage. I think a marijuana user in this audience would not argue with any of these. These are those same signs and symptoms when you relate it to driving. So poor attention to tasks, time and distance perception. It's not unusual for officers to say that they recognize somebody who's probably smoking and driving because they parked or they stopped their car 30 feet before the stop sign. Slower braking reaction time. Those individuals that say they drive better when they're high, what they're not taking into account is when you have to do something suddenly. A car runs a red light and you have to stop quickly. That reaction time is dramatically reduced when it comes to driving. So these are some of the other ones that we see with this population. And these are some of the effects on driving with just a variety of different drugs. And given the time, I'm not going to go into all these, but typically if there's a common theme, it's a slower reaction time. And depending on the drug and the user, the reaction time could be dramatically different. So I want to talk to you a little bit about policy and why this is such a challenge. Now, in most states where you have medical marijuana, you can purchase anywhere from 1 to 3 ounces of marijuana. You can have, that was in Nevada last week, their law allows for you to grow 3 plants for personal use. Just to put this in perspective, 1 ounce of marijuana is about 60 joints. And again, I mentioned 1 to 6, some states allow 15 plants. This is 1 plant. An individual, a prosecutor, sent this to me. If you look in the corner, you can see a man standing there. That is 1 plant. You could probably provide marijuana to a small city with that 1 plant. So some of the challenges. With drugs, there are hundreds of drugs, and they have different effects, varying effects on your ability to function under any circumstances, let alone your ability to drive a vehicle. Alcohol is pretty simple. When we're looking at data, we have robust data when it comes to alcohol. We don't have good data when it comes to driving under the influence of drugs. We're seeing more drivers driving under the influence of drugs. We're seeing fewer driving drunk. And probably the most important thing is people generally recognize driving drunk is socially unacceptable. We are not there yet when it comes to driving under the influence of drugs. So there are many drugs out there. Any of you who are involved with your drug testing labs, I'm sure will tell you that a drug that you can positively test today, it's a synthetic drug, you may not be able to test the same way tomorrow if they just adjust 1 compound. So it's really kind of chasing the tail in terms of keeping your head above water with all of the different drugs that are out there. And then, as I mentioned before, presence versus impairment are two different animals. And testing doesn't necessarily give you that information. There's no equivalent to a 0.08 BAC. And you've probably all heard that 5 nanograms is kind of the number that people tend to look at for impairment when it comes to marijuana. How many of you think that figure was arrived at by scientists? It was arrived at by politicians. And as I understand it, this is what happened. There was one group that said, let's make it 10 nanograms. There was another group that said, no, let's make it 1 nanogram. And they said, the hell with it. Let's split the difference and make it 5. That doesn't tell you impairment. These drugs impact people in different ways. The lifelong user is going to react differently than somebody that is the occasional user, but those are some of the issues that we have in trying to address the testing issues. Some of the other challenges is how it's ingested, getting people to recognize that the marijuana that made it today is not the gray weed that was around in Woodstock, that was maybe 3 or 4% THC, and now we can have 80% THC. So how it's ingested and what that looks like can really impact what that impairment looks like. So here are just a couple of examples. You have chocolate bars, you have soda, you have the good old-fashioned joint, you've got bongs, you've got on the left, or on the right, I should say, is something called shatter, which is basically like a condensed, heavy-duty hash. How you can be ingesting it. So there's a picture of an individual vaping. When you see somebody vaping in a car, what are they doing? They might be smoking tobacco. They might be smoking hash. They might be smoking marijuana. We don't know. So how it's ingested can really vary. In the middle, you see there are inhalers. Those are inhalers for marijuana. There are health drinks that you can get in Washington State that is mixed with marijuana. So there's some really creative people out there that have come up with lots of different ways to ingest this. I will point out in the middle, and who would have thought this, those are marijuana suppositories. So if you ever have a client who says that they were stoned off their ass, that might be a figure of speech. That might be exactly what they were up to. I'm going to skip this individual. But there are also lots and lots of edibles. And one of the other challenges is that the way they wrap these are attractive to kids. And when a kid sees a candy bar, what are they going to do? They're going to be going after that. So these are just some of the examples of how these things can be displayed. And another challenge is, while you might think one candy bar is one dose, it's actually one square of the candy bar. And what they're seeing now in emergency rooms, because of the fact that we live in a society where you want immediate gratification, you break that one square, how long does it take for marijuana to, when you do use an edible, how long does it take before you feel it, start feeling the effects? What the research says is about an hour, hour and a half before you really start feeling the effects. So you break off one square and you're going, ah, this stuff isn't working. I'm going to have half the candy bar. And then what happens? You are pretty much out of your mind. You may end up finding yourself in an emergency room. But people don't recognize the time it takes for ingestion. And if you relate this to driving behavior, same thing. Well, I'm not feeling anything now. And you could be on the highway an hour later going, why is there blood coming out of the road, or whatever it is that they think that they're seeing? So again, I'm going to really point out what Colorado is doing. That is a candy bar wrapper over the side of a car. So again, basically not saying your head's going to fall off if you do this, but the message is very clear. If you're high, don't drive. If you're going to use an edible, make sure you're safe. You're off the road. This. Let's talk about some of the issues with enforcement. And this addresses not just police, but I want to talk about prosecutors and some of the challenges when it comes to the judicial system as well. So as I mentioned, what's this guy doing? Is he smoking marijuana? Is he smoking tobacco? We don't know. So a friend sent the same one guy who sent me the picture of the big plant. This was a grow house. Does it look like a grow house? Not so much. And typically one of the ways when they investigate these that they can tell if a grow house exists is their electric bill. Because it's going to be off the charts compared to any of the other homes in the neighborhood. Unless they're all grow houses, then we're probably kind of messed up with that one. So here is one of the challenges. And it's something, it's a very important takeaway for any of you that work with DUI cases. And that is this. A DUI investigation is the only crime where the investigation oftentimes stops when we have a .08, when we have the impairment. Officers don't necessarily continue to look to see if drugs were involved as well. So, spoiler alert, but when you're dealing with a DUI, don't for a second think that alcohol is the only thing that they had on board. The fact it wasn't tested doesn't mean that that isn't a distinct possibility. And I'm going to talk about testing in a little bit, but keep that in the back of your mind. So if you're only testing for marijuana, you can do well in court. You've got the .08. The judge understands that. The jury typically understands it. If that's the kind of case you have, that's easy peasy. When you're talking about going after drugs, it's much more complex. So part of the issue is that police officers are not necessarily trained to understand this. Drug recognition experts, these are police officers that are trained to understand this roadside, are few and far between. It takes about 160 hours of training to become a DRE, so it's a big commitment. And as you all know, what happens when you have somebody that is a go-getter and, yes, I'm going to volunteer, I want to be a DRE, what's going to happen? They're going to get promoted. And it's interesting because the statistics I see by state, the number of people who have been trained in DRE versus the number that are actively using it is pretty darn significant. So the other challenge is testing is time-consuming, it's expensive when it comes to doing an arrest. Prosecutors are not necessarily familiar with DUID cases. Judges are not necessarily familiar with it. Juries are also not familiar with it. One of the comments I've heard from prosecutors is getting juries to understand, again, this is not the marijuana that maybe they smoked when they were in college in the 70s. This is a different animal. So officers need more tools. That's one of the challenges. Some of the testing that is most effective is oral fluid testing. And there is a chart here, basically, of some of the testing options when it comes to DUID. The quality of oral fluid tests can vary quite a bit. And again, money seems to be kind of a bottom line wherever I go when it comes to testing, when it comes to how we are dealing with this population. There are a couple of tools that are on the horizon that you should keep your eye on. One is there are a number of companies that have been working on a cannabis breathalyzer. And if you develop one, you're rich. You're going to be really wealthy. So these probably have a ways to go. Also, being able to test via fingerprints is another option that's being worked at. Until they drive the expense of that down, it's probably going to be a while before we see it. But I will tell you that vendors are actively looking at ways to accurately capture this information. So Montana has, and every state in the country has, a DUID report card that was put together through AAA. I just want to touch on these. This is law enforcement officers should be trained on field sobriety and the National Highway Safety Administration drugs and care curriculum. And what we have here is total number of officers in the state, which they showed as about 1,600. Number trained on SFST was about the same number. They didn't report the number of DREs that have been trained, but they show actively participating DREs as 56. Another recommendation in terms of best practices with this population, being able to distinguish between alcohol DUI and drug DUI, and you're doing that, which I can't say the same thing about California. So that is great information. No state laws regarding reporting test results for purposes other than prosecution. State law regarding testing a driver involving a fatal crash. And state law allows for testing a driver, so that information is something that probably could be tightened up on. Again, we won't know the state of DUID unless each state is reporting this information so we have it available. So let's talk about probation. Let's talk about supervision and some of the best practices. So the first recommendation, and this is where you can be working with your drug testing labs, is to find out not what's going on in your state so much, but what's going on in your communities. Because communities differ. There are parts of my state in Arizona where PCP is going through the roof, other parts where it's opioids. And your labs will be able to tell you based on what their findings are, what they're seeing. So it's really important to be asking some of those questions. Assessment, upfront assessment to determine risk with these individuals is the place to start. So shameless plug, I'm going to be doing a training this afternoon on using assessment tools. And second shameless plug, tomorrow afternoon I'm doing a certification training on impaired driver assessment at City Hall, and it is free. And if you or whoever you want to send to this, if you're interested, if you participate in this, you're actually certified to use the tool at the end of the training. So I'll give you some information on that later. But you want to start with assessment. These are the risk factors for DUI recidivism. These are the big five. Prior involvement in the justice system related to impaired driving. Prior non-DUI involvement in the justice system, and that is individuals who are getting lots of traffic tickets for speeding, running red lights, and individuals that have other felonies for non-drug related charges. Prior involvement not only with alcohol but other drugs, so those poly substance users. Mental health and mood adjustment, strong correlation, was 33% of men with multiple DUIs, 50% of women with multiple DUIs have a psychiatric disorder. And then finally, resistance and noncompliance. The people that have failed treatment, that failed interlock, those are the big DUI factors, and the same big five apply to DUID cases as well. And it's important to remember when we're talking about DUIs, there's a tendency to want to be chasing the bottle or chase the drug. You probably have been up to here when it comes to EDP, and I get that. But don't forget, if you want to be addressing this behavior, you've got to be addressing the big four, the antisocial thinking, antisocial behavior, antisocial associates. All of those factors are the drivers when it comes to impaired driving and substance abuse. So here are some of the assessment tools that are out there that you should consider. And if you're not using a specific DUI-centered assessment tool, my guess is you're probably going to find that these people are scoring out as low risk, and you know that they're not, especially when it comes to misdemeanors. So assessments should be driving your decision-making, what you're going to be doing with this person, what that dosage of supervision looks like, all those different factors. And again, with impaired drivers, don't assume alcohol only means alcohol or marijuana only means marijuana. These are clever people. Technologies. One of the questions that I have been asked is, do we use ignition interlock with somebody with DUID? And there are pros and cons to it. The pros are, because these are polysubstance users, there's a stronger likelihood that if they're using marijuana, they're going to use alcohol. The con is, there's an expense associated with that. So I would never tell you, you must use interlock. If you have it in your toolbox, in some states they require that you use an interlock, even if it was for driving while under the influence of drugs. So your choice, but that is an option in terms of roadside safety. So let me talk to you a little bit about testing with this population. The recommendation that I would give you is that anybody that comes into your DUI court, you do a broad panel drug test. And what TASC, which is one of the organizations that's kind of a leader in testing, recommend is if you are looking at the following drugs. And here's why this is so important. What happens when you have somebody that you test and they're using a drug that you're not testing for? Two things. One is, oh joy, I get to keep using synthetic marijuana. And the second thing is, they're going to tell everybody that they know who is involved with probation that this is what's going on. So keep that in mind and watch how quickly I can use this clicker to zoom ahead to the last couple slides. Other question. DUID, do you put them in drug court? Do you put them in DUI court? National Center for DUI Court said you really want to be focusing on behaviors. Therefore, the DUID case, you should be putting in a DUI court. Treatment doesn't necessarily have to be in that in the same regimen, but the behaviors for DUID look the same as behaviors for DUI. And a couple resources for you. Governor's Highway Safety Administration put together a really good manual on drug driving. AAA also has a number of manual items on drug driving as well. This is the important thing to remember. Again, don't forget this picture. This is why it's so important that we are looking at DUID cases. And then, finally, if any of you are interested in this training tomorrow, that is the information, and Laura Neal is your contact person if you're interested. This is my contact information. If there is any information I can provide you in terms of research, I know I just tore through this. I did this in 3 hours a couple weeks ago. But if there's anything I can do to help you, please don't hesitate to contact me. I promise you I'll get back to you right away. And with that said, Jeff, it is 20 after.
Close.